I could see her, out in the water. She was calling to you. Her voice infiltrated your mind. How? He asks again. At the boathouse, she whispered something in your ear. She claimed you as hers, making it impossible for you to think of anything or anyone else. It was only a matter of time until she beckoned you. Since you've remained on the island, hidden, she couldn't physically pull you out into the water. So she had to slip her voice into your mind and make you come in search of her. He shakes his head, unable to rectify what has just happened to him. Olivia Green, I tell him bluntly, is Marguerite Swan. She was waiting for you out in the harbor. She would have pulled you to her, her lips on yours, and then she would have drowned you. He leans forward against his knees, teeth clamped shut. I stare at the scar beside his left eye. His cheekbones are starting to blaze from the heat of the fire. My focus slides back to his lips, to the way they felt pressed to mine.
But how do you know that? He asks. How can you be so sure it's Marguerite Swan who's taken over Olivia's body, and not one of the other sisters?
He squints, like he can't believe his own question, that he's even asking it.
You just need to trust me, I say.
Marguerite wants to kill you, and she won't stop until she finds a way to do it.
Why me? He asks.
Because she saw you with me at the boathouse.
What does that have to do with anything?
My fingers tremble slightly. My heart pushes against my ribs, warning me not to tell him the truth. But the truth tastes like letting go, like the sharpness of sunlight on a spring day, and my head begins to pulse with every heartbeat. I can see them, I confess, the words tumbling out before I can catch them.
Them?
The sisters. I can see Aurora inside of Gigi Klein and Marguerite inside of Olivia Green. I know whose bodies they've taken. He straightens, lifting his elbows away from his knees.
How is that even possible?
I shake my head, the air gone from my lungs, and a shiver races up my entire body.
You can see them and you haven't said anything?
No one knows.
But...
His mouth dips open, eyes narrowed on me.
You can see what they really are?
Yes. I stand up, crossing my arms. I can tell he's trying to piece it all together, make everything fit. But his mind is fighting him. He doesn't want to believe what I'm telling him could be true.
How long have you been able to do this?
Always.
But how?
I lift my shoulders.
I don't know.
I mean, it's just something I've always been able to do. I'm rambling, getting lost in the explanation, in the deception beneath the truth.
Can your mom see them too?
I shake my head. He frowns and looks down into the fire, rubbing the back of his neck with his right hand.
Do they know? Do the sisters know you can see them?
Yes. Again, his mouth parts open, searching for words, for the right question to make this all make sense.
What about the third one, the third sister?
Hazel, I answer for him.
Where is she? Whose body has she stolen?
I don't know.
You haven't seen her yet?
No.
But she's out there somewhere.
Yes.
And she hasn't killed anyone yet?
I shake my head.
Not yet. So there's still time to find her and stop her.
There's no stopping them, I answer.
Have you tried?
I can't meet his eyes.
No.
It's pointless to try. I think about my encounter with Gigi in the boathouse.
I had thought foolishly maybe I could talk to her, the real her, Aurora. Maybe some part of her was still human, still had a beating heart that would be tired of the killing. But Lon interrupted us, and I sense she's too far gone anyway. My words would never be enough. Beau drops his palm from the back of his neck, and I can see in his eyes that he's starting to believe me. "Fuck, Penny," he says, standing up and taking a step toward me. "So Lon and Davis were right. They do have a Swan sister locked in that boathouse?" I nod. "And Olivia, or Marguerite, whatever her name is trying to kill me?" "She's already slipped into your mind. She can make you see things that aren't there, feel things that aren't real." "When I saw her," he says, "in the water, waiting for me, it felt like I needed her, like I'd die if I didn't get to her, like..." He swallows back the words, choking on them. "Like you loved her?" I finish for him. "Yeah." His eyes find mine. "She can convince you that you've never loved anyone quite so much or ever will again." He clenches his fists together at his sides, and I watch the motion, his forearms flexing, his temples pulsing. "And then you were there," he says, recounting the moment when I jumped into the ocean after him. "I could hear you, but I couldn't focus on you. You seemed so far away. But then I felt your hands. You were right in front of me." He looks up, the darkest centers of his eyes like the darkest depths of the ocean. "And then you kissed me." "I..." My voice feels strangled in my throat. "I had to stop you." A beat of silence. My heart stumbles, catches, restarts again. "After that," he says, "I didn't feel her calling me anymore. I still don't." "Maybe we broke her hold on you," I say, my voice feeling small. "You broke her hold on me." Words tangle up on my tongue, all the things I want to say. "I needed to bring you back. I couldn't let you go. I couldn't lose you. I couldn't let..." The weight of my honesty rattles the very center of my ribs, my stomach, the place just behind my eyes. "I couldn't let her have you." I don't allow myself to look away from him. I need him to speak, to wash over my words with his own. In his eyes, a storm waits at the edges. His hand lifts, and his fingers slide up the ridge of my cheekbone and behind my ear. The sensation of his fingertips against my skin unweaves the stone knitted together at the base of my heart. I close my eyes briefly, then open them again, a craving rising up inside me, pure and uncorrupt. He pulls me forward, and I pause only a feather's width from his mouth. I look into his eyes, trying to root myself in the moment. And then he kisses me, like he needs me to root him here too. His lips are warm and his fingertips cold. All at once I am wrapped up in him, his heart battering just beneath his chest, his hands in my hair, his mouth searching my lower lip. He is everywhere, filling my lungs in the space between each breath, and I feel myself falling, tumbling like a star dropping from the sky and spinning toward earth. My heart stretches outward, becomes light and jittery. This moment, this boy, could tear me apart and upend everything. But in the heat of the cottage, wind rattling the glass in the windows, rain pelting the roof, with our skin flecked with salt water, I don't care. I let his hands roam my chilled flesh, and my fingers weave up the back of his neck.
I don't want to be anywhere else. I only want him. Him. Love is an enchantress, devious and wild. It sneaks up behind you, soft and gentle and quiet, just before it slits your throat. I wake on the hardwood floor beside the fireplace, Beau asleep next to me, his arm folded over my hip bone. He is breathing softly against my hair. My eyes skirt across the living room, remembering where I am. His cottage. The fire has turned to coals, all the logs burned down. So I shimmy from beneath his arm, his fingers twitching, and slide a fresh log into the fireplace, pushing it through the coals. It takes only a moment for the flames to reignite. I cross my legs and run my fingers through his hair. I smell like him, his t-shirt still against my skin. I know I can't leave him alone now. Marguerite will try again, and I won't let her have him. This thing I feel for him is working its way into my bones, like water through cracks in my surface. When it freezes, it will either shatter me into a million pieces or make me stronger. I pick up one of the books sitting on the floor next to me, flipping through the pages. There are notes in the margins, paragraphs highlighted, corners dog-eared. The ink is faded and smeared in places. I think they were your father's books, Beau says. His eyes are open, but he's still lying on the floor watching me. He must have heard me sit up. Why do you think that? They were purchased from a bookstore in town, and there's a name in the front of that one. I flip back to the front cover, where a piece of paper sits tucked into the crease. Handwritten with black ink on the paper is the name John Talbot. It was a book he had special ordered, or maybe put on hold, and an employee wrote his name on a slip of paper until he came to pay for it. Your father was John Talbot, right?
Yeah.
Beneath the paper is a folded receipt from the Olive Street Tea and Bookhouse. It's dated June 5th, 3 years earlier, only a week before he disappeared.
He must have been researching the Swan Sisters, Beau says. Maybe he was looking for a way to stop them.
A scattering of memories crack through me, of the night I saw him moving down to the dock in the dark, the night he vanished. The rain fell sideways, and the wind ripped shingles from the roof of the house, but he would never return to repair them. He had been collecting these books all along, in secret, looking for a way to end the swan season.
Are you all right?
Beau sits up, creases formed between his brows. Fine. I close the cover of the book and set it back on the floor. And you've read most of them? I ask. He nods, stretching upright. And what did you find?
Mostly speculation about witches and curses. Nothing definitive.
Anything about how to end a curse? He shifts his gaze to me, exhaling.
Only the obvious.
Which is?
Destroy the purveyors of it.
The sisters.
The only way to end it would be to kill them, he says.
But then both the Swan Sister and the girl whose body they stole would die. He nods. And you still want to kill Gigi Klein? I ask.
I want whoever killed my brother to pay for it. And if the only way to do that is to destroy both the girl and the monster, then that's what I'll do.
I brush both hands through my hair, catching on knots that my fingers must work through before I can twist my mass of hair over my shoulder. Does this mean you believe in the Swan Sisters now?
I don't think I have a choice, he says. One of them is trying to kill me.
The fullness of his lips seems amplified as he pushes them together, a rivulet of tension passing over his expression. It can't be easy knowing someone, something, wants you dead. But what's even harder
is knowing it's your fault. Marguerite wouldn't want Beau so badly if you were just some random tourist. It's because of me that she's so intrigued by him. She loves a challenge. And Beau is the perfect prey. I stand up from the floor. Otis and Olga had been sleeping on the couch, curled up together at one end. But now Olga is awake, her ears alert, head turned toward the door. "I'm sorry you're here," I say, rubbing my palms down my arms. "I'm sorry you got dragged into this."
"It's not your fault."
His voice is deep, his eyebrows angled downward, softening the hard edges of his face.
"I came here because of my brother. I did this, not you."
"If you weren't on this island with me," I tell him, forcing the tears down so they don't rise up, "then she wouldn't want you. I was wrong when I thought keeping you here on the island would make you safe. She'll find you wherever you are."
"No."
He stands up too, but doesn't touch me. Doesn't run his hands up my arms to comfort me. "Not yet."
"She's not in my head anymore," he says. "I don't hear her voice, feel her thoughts. You broke whatever hold she had on me."
"For now. But she'll try again. She'll come for you, here to the island if she has to. She'll physically drag you out into the water. She won't give up."
"If I'm not safe, then you're not safe."
"It doesn't work like that," I tell him. "It's you she will drown, not me." My stomach begins to wrench and turn.
"If you can see them and they know it, then you're in danger too."
I think of Marguerite out in the harbor, waiting for Beau, beckoning him with the promise of her lips skimming delicately over his. She is a wraith, dredged up from the seafloor. She is vengeful and clever. She is single-minded in her hatred for this town. And she won't stop. "You can't protect me," I tell him. "Just like I can't protect you." Olga hops down from the couch and trots between us to the front door, stretching up on her hind legs to scratch at the wood. She begins to mew, and it wakes Otis.
"I can try,"
Beau says, moving closer, and in his eyes I see the ocean, and it draws me into him like the tide against the sand. His hands find me in the firelight, grazing my wrists, my arms, and then his palms slide up to my jaw, through my hair, fingerprints on my skin, and for a moment, I believe him. Maybe he can keep me safe. Maybe this thing threading between us is enough to keep all the terrors at bay. I suck in a breath and try to steady the two halves of my heart. But when his lips brush against mine, I lose all rooting to the earth. My heart turns wild. His fingers pull me closer, and I press myself against him, needing the steadiness of his heartbeat inside his chest and the balance of his arms. My own fingers slide up beneath his shirt, feeling the firmness of his torso, air filling his lungs. He is strong, stronger than most. Maybe he can survive this town, survive Marguerite, survive me. I dig my fingers into his skin, his shoulders, losing myself to him. He feels like everything, all that's left. The world has been shredded around me, but this might be enough to smooth the brittle edges of my once beating heart. The fire makes the heat between us almost unbearable, but we fold ourselves together among the pages of books and the blankets scattered across the floor. The wind roars outside. His fingers trace the moons of my hip bones, my thighs, my shivering heartbeat. He kisses down my throat, the place where my secrets are kept. He kisses my collarbone, where the skin is thin and delicate, patterns of freckles like a sailor's map. He kisses so softly, it feels like wings or a whisper. He kisses, and I slip, slip, slip beneath his touch, crumbling. His lips inch beneath my shirt, along the curves of my body, valleys and hills, breathing promises he'll keep against my skin. My clothes feel burdensome and heavy, clothes that belong to him, boxers and a t-shirt, so I peel them away. My mind spins. My breathing catches, then rises again. My skin crackles, subtle light, and his touch feels infinite, fathomless, a wave that rolls ashore but never ends. He is gentle and sweet, and I never want his hands, his lips, to be anywhere else but against me. The morning sunlight is just starting to break above the horizon, soft pinks sifting through the windows, but I am breaking here on the floor, shattering into pieces as he whispers my name, and I see only flecks of light shivering across my vision. And after, he holds his lips above mine, breathing the same air, my skin shimmering from the heat, sweat dewing the curves of my body. He kisses my nose, my forehead, my earlobes. I have doomed him, kept him here, made him the prey of Marguerite Swan. He is caught in the tempest of a season that could kill him. He needs to leave Sparrow, escape this wretched place. Yet I need him to stay. I need him. John Talbot. On June 5th, a week before he vanished, John Talbot entered the Olive Street Tea and Bookhouse. He had special ordered 4 books a week earlier, titles he had researched online that contained real-life accounts of hexes and curses that had been documented in other unfortunate towns. It was not unusual for locals in Sparrow to take an interest in the Swan Sisters. They often collected newspaper clippings and old photographs of the town from when the sisters were still alive. They shared stories at the Silver Dollar Pub over too many beers, and then stumbled down to the docks and shouted into the night about their sons and brothers who they've lost. And sometimes, they even became obsessed. Sorrow and desperation can make cracks along the mind. But John Talbot never shared his theories. He never got drunk and lamented the tragedy of Sparrow over a pint. He never told anyone about the collection of books he kept stashed in Anchor Cottage. Not even his wife. And on that bright, warm afternoon, as he left the bookstore, there was a frenzy in his shadowed eyes, lines of worry carved along his forehead. His gaze darted side to side as if the sunlight were unbearable, and he pushed through the horde of tourists back down to the skiff waiting at the dock. Those who saw him that day would later say he had the look of someone overcome with sea madness. The island had been known to drive people insane. The salt air, the isolation, it had finally gotten to him. John Talbot had lost his mind. Chapter 13. 2 days slip by uncounted. Beau's fingers coil through my hair. He watches me sleep. And he keeps me warm when the wind tears through the cracks in the cottage windows in the early hours of morning. He slides himself beside me beneath the wool blanket and runs his fingertips down my arm. I've forgotten about everything else but this little room, this fireplace, this spot in my heart that aches to the point of bursting. On the 3rd day, we wake and walk down the rows of the newly revived orchard trees under a tepid afternoon sky. The leaves are beginning to unfurl, and the flowers just starting to break open. This season's apples and pears might still be stunted and hard and inedible. But by next year, hopefully our hard work will produce fat, sun-sweetened fruit. "What were you like in school?" I ask, craning my head upward to soak up the sun. Little white spots dance across my closed eyelids. "What do you mean?" Were you popular?
He reaches out a hand and touches the craggy end of a branch, small green leaves sliding through his palm.
No.
But you had friends?
A few.
He glances at me, his jade green eyes spearing a hole straight through my center.
Did you play sports?
I'm trying to piece together the person he was, the person he is, and I find it hard to imagine him anywhere else but here in Sparrow, on this island with me. He shakes his head, smiling a little, like he finds it funny that I would even ask this.
I worked for my parents every day after school, so I didn't have much time for friends or group sports.
Your parents' farm?
It's actually a vineyard.
I pause near the end of a row.
A vineyard? I repeat.
Like grapes?
Yeah. It's just a small family winery, but it does pretty well.
It's not exactly the farm where I imagined him toiling. Hands in the earth, greasy, cow manure type of farming. But I'm sure it was still hard work.
It's not what I pictured, I tell him.
Why not?
I don't know.
I examine him, eyeing his faded gray sweatshirt and jeans. Do your parents know where you are?
No. They didn't want me to come here. They said I just needed to let Kyle go. That's how they coped with his death, by ignoring it. But I knew I had to come. So when I graduated this year, I hitchhiked down the coast. I never told them I was leaving.
Have you talked to them since you left?
He shakes his head, pushing his hands into his jean pockets.
They're probably worried about you, I say.
I can't call them. I don't know what I'd say.
He looks at me.
How do I explain what's going on here? That Kyle didn't kill himself, but was drowned by one of three sisters who died 2 centuries ago?
Maybe don't tell them that, I offer. But you should probably let them know you're okay. Tell them something. Even a lie.
Yeah.
His voice dips low.
Maybe.
We reach the end of the orchard, where one of the dead apple trees is now gone, torched down to its roots. When this is all over, I say, after the summer solstice, will you go home?
No.
He pauses to look back down the rows of perfectly spaced fruit trees. A small gray bird bursts out from the limbs of one tree and lands on the branch of another.
I won't go back there. Not now. Before Kyle died, I always thought I'd stay and work for my parents after high school, take over the family business. It was what they expected of me. My brother would be the one to move away and live a different life. To escape. And I was okay with that. But after he died.
He draws in his lips and looks up through the limbs of an apple tree, buds pushing out from the green stalks.
I knew I wanted something different. Something that was mine. I had always been the one who would stay behind while Kyle saw the world. But not anymore.
So now what do you want? I ask, my voice soft, not wanting to crack apart his thoughts.
I want to be out there.
He nods to the western edge of the island.
On the water.
He looks back at me like he's not sure I'll understand.
When my dad taught me to sail, I knew I loved it, but I didn't think I'd ever have the chance to really do it. Maybe now I can. I could buy a sailboat, leave. Maybe I won't ever come back.
Sounds like an escape plan. Like you want to start a whole new life. His eyes flicker, and he squares his shoulders to face me.
I do. I have money. I've been saving most of my life.
His stare turns cool and serious.
You could come with me.
I draw in both my lips, holding back a betraying smile.
You don't have to stay in this town. You could escape too. Leave this place behind if it's what you want. I have school. I'll wait for you. He says it like he actually means it. But my mom, I say, just another excuse. His mouth hardens in place. It's just not that easy for me, I explain. I feel wrenched into halves, torn between the wanting and the prison that is this island. It's not a no, but I also can't say yes. I can see the hurt in his eyes, that he doesn't understand even if he wants to. But he slides his fingers around my waist, gently, like he's afraid I'll spook like one of the island birds, and he pulls me to him. Someday you'll find a worthy enough reason to leave this place, he says. I once read a poem about love being fragile, as thin as glass and easily broken. But that is not the kind of love that survives in a place like this. It must be hardy and enduring. It must have grit. He's strong, I think, the same thought I had the other night. I blink up at him, the sunlight scattering through the trees, making the features of his face soft at the edges. Stronger than most boys. He could survive this place. He's made of something different, his heart weathered and battered just like mine, forged of hard metals and earth. We've both lost things, lost people. We are broken but fighting to stay alive. Maybe that's why I need him. He feels like I feel, wants like I want. He stirred loose something inside my chest, a cold center where blood now pumps, a hint of life, of green pushing up towards sunlight. I might love him, and it has tilted my universe off-center, the frayed edges of my life starting to unravel. Loving someone is dangerous. It gives you something to lose. I lift up to my tiptoes, his lips hovering over mine, and I know he's looking for answers in the steady calm of my stare. But he won't find them there, so he presses his mouth to mine, as if he might press some truth out of me. But I can only give him this moment, and I climb my fingers up his chest, breathing him in, tasting the salt air on his lips. I wish suddenly that I could promise him forever, promise him me, but it would be a lie. I try to call Rose. I leave messages on her phone. I tell her mom to have her call me back, but she never does. Where is she? Why won't she call me? But I can't leave this island. I can't risk leaving Beau alone. I'm afraid Olivia might try to lure him into the harbor again. But after several days, I can't take it anymore. The not knowing is making me edgy and nervous. I wake up early, hoping to slip out of the cottage before Beau sees me. Olga trails me to the door. Her eyes are watery from the cold, and she blinks, as if curious about what I'm doing awake at this hour. I pull on my raincoat hanging from a metal hook beside the door, then turn the knob. A swift breeze rips into the cottage, spraying raindrops over my face. Olga zips past my feet and trots up the boardwalk, but then she stops short, ears alert, tail swishing back and forth. Something has caught her attention. It's still an hour or so before sunrise, but the sky has turned aqueous and lucid, morning pressing down, breaking apart the night clouds, and shearing the island terrain in a hue of blush pink. And in the distance, I see what Olga sees. A light is wavering across the water, and an engine is sputtering toward the island dock.
What is it? Beau asks. His voice a shock to my ears.
I wasn't expecting him to be awake. The door is partway open, and I glance back inside. He's standing up, rubbing his face. Someone's here, I say. Chapter 14. A boat knocks loudly against the dock, motoring too fast across the water.
It's Heath's boat. I recognize it as the same one we took out into the harbor to make wishes at the pirate's ship when we found the first body. But Heath is not driving it. It's Rose. And someone is with her. A girl. Beau grabs my arm, stopping me from getting any closer to the boat as Rose struggles to tie a rope around one of the cleats on the dock. He recognizes the girl before I do. It's Gigi Klein. Rose? I ask, and she notices us for the first time. I didn't have anywhere else to go, she says frantically when her eyes meet mine. She looks scared, in a state of shock, and her red wavy hair is windblown like a person who's recently escaped from an asylum. What did you do? I ask. I had to help her, and I couldn't hide her in town. They'd find her. So I brought her here. I thought she'd be safe. You could hide her in the lighthouse or the other cottage. I don't know, I panicked. I didn't know what else to do. She's speaking too fast, and her eyes keep flicking from Gigi back to me. You broke Gigi out of the boathouse? Beau asks. Gigi is sitting silently in the boat, meekly, innocently. Her facade is well practiced as she makes slow, measured movements. Each blink of an eyelash looks rehearsed. I had to. No, you didn't, I snap. This was a very bad idea, Rose. I couldn't just let them keep her locked up like that. It was cruel. And they could just as easily do it to anyone else. To me. To us. And they probably will when they find out what you've done. Penny, please, she says. Stepping from the boat, palms lifted in the air. You have to help her. I didn't realize Gigi's imprisonment upset Rose this deeply, enough that she would break her out and bring her here. I know they were friends once, years ago, but I never imagined she'd do this. She couldn't stand to see someone she once cared about tied up and suffering, made to be a cruel spectacle. It didn't seem right to Rose from the start. But I can't fault her for that. This is dangerous, Rose. You shouldn't have freed her. I lock eyes with Gigi, with Aurora tucked inside her, watching like an animal waiting until it's safe to come out of its hiding place. She didn't have to enchant Davis or Lon to save her. Rose did it out of the goodness of her heart. But she set loose a monster, and she doesn't even realize it. Maybe it's better that she's here, Beau whispers to me, out of earshot of Rose and Gigi. I feel my eyebrows slant into a scowl. What are you talking about? We can keep an eye on her, lock her up, make sure she doesn't kill anyone else. I know why he wants to do this. He wants to ask Gigi about his brother, and if he decides that it was Aurora, hidden inside of Gigi, who killed his brother... Then what? Will he try to kill her? This is a mistake, I can feel it. But both Beau and Rose are staring at me, waiting for me to decide what to do. This can't be happening. Fine. Get her out of the boat. We'll take her to Old Fisherman's Cottage. Then we'll decide what to do next. Sometimes I think the island is a magnet for bad things. The center of it all, like a black hole pulling us toward a fate we can't prevent. And other times, I think this island is the only thing keeping me sane, the only familiar thing I have left. Or maybe it's me that's a black hole, and everyone around me can't help but be swallowed up, drowned and trapped in my orbit. But I also know that there's nothing I can do to change it. The island and I are the same. I lead the way to Old Fisherman's Cottage, Rose trailing behind me, then Gigi and Beau bringing up the back. He wants to make sure Gigi doesn't make a run for it. The door is unlocked, and the interior is darker and damper and colder than Beau's cottage. I flip on a light switch, but nothing happens. I walk across the living room floor, furnished with a single wood rocking chair, and a burgundy upholstered ottoman that doesn't match anything else in the room. I find a floor lamp, kneel down to plug it in, and it immediately blinks on. But the light does little to brighten the appearance of the cottage. It's only temporary, Rose assures Gigi. But I'm not sure what Rose thinks will happen to change the current circumstances. Kidnapping Gigi from the boathouse will only make Davis and Lon more suspicious. They will assume one of the Swan sisters broke her out, and now they'll be looking for her. And Rose and I will likely be their first suspects since both she and I were caught sneaking into the boathouse. And now I know why Rose was there. She was planning this all along. We'll bring you wood for the fireplace, I say to Gigi, but her eyes don't lift from the floor. She's staring at a corner of the living room rug, the edges frayed, probably chewed up by mice. And I'll find you some new clothes, Rose offers, looking down at Gigi's stained shirt and jeans. I tug up the only two windows in the cottage, seeing if they'll slide up in their casings, but they don't even budge. Both are rusted shut. This cottage is much older than the one Beau is staying in, and these windows probably haven't been opened in 2 decades. I walk back to the door, not wanting to be in the same room as Gigi any longer than I have to. You're safe here, I hear Rose tell her, and Beau steps through the doorway, shooting me a sideways glance. We both know what she really is, and I can tell Beau is itching to interrogate her. Can I have something to eat? Gigi asks. Rose nods. Of course. We'll bring you food, too. She has no idea who she has just invited to the island. Try to get some rest. I'm sure you're exhausted. Once Rose has stepped through the doorway, I shut the door, and Beau drags over a warped wood board that had been stacked along the backside of the cottage. He jams it up under the doorknob, locking it in place. What are you doing? Rose asks, making a move to grab the board. She's not a prisoner. If you want me to hide her here, then this is how it has to be, I explain. You don't actually think she did anything wrong, that she's one of them, do you? Rose might not believe in the Swan sisters, but she knows that I do. You don't have any reason to think she's innocent, I say. So for now, she stays locked in there. At least it's better than the boathouse. Hardly, Rose counters, but she crosses her arms and steps back from the door, reluctantly agreeing to our rules. Does Heath know what you did? I ask. She shakes her head. No, but I borrowed his parents' boat, so I'll probably have to tell him where I've been. He can't say anything to anyone about this. He won't.
And no one saw you take her? Beau asks.
It was dark, and Lon was completely passed out. He probably hasn't even realized she's gone yet. Again, I'm struck by what a horrible idea this is. I'm not even sure if we're hiding Gigi from Lon and Davis, or if we're holding her hostage just like they did. Whatever it is that we're doing, I'm fairly certain it's going to end catastrophically. Just be careful in town, I say. I will. And she presses her hands down deep into her coat pockets, as if she were fighting off a sudden chill. Thank you, she adds, just before she heads down the walkway back to the dock. Beau and I look at each other once she's out of sight.
Now what? He asks.
Back at the house, I make 2 peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for Gigi, wrap them in foil, and grab a blanket from the hall closet. When I reach the door of the old fisherman's cottage, the wood board has been removed, and the door is slightly ajar. At first, my heart jumps upward with panic. Gigi must have gotten out. But then I hear Beau's voice inside. He went to collect logs to start a fire for her while I went to make food, and he's returned before me. I pause, listening to the crackling of flames in the fireplace.
I know what you are, I hear Beau say.
Do you? Gigi answers, her voice farther away, across the living room maybe, sitting in the only chair. I touch the doorknob with my fingers, then pause. Maybe I owe him this, the chance to question her about his brother. So I wait before entering.
"You're not Gigi Cly," he says coolly, his voice measured and precise. "You're something else."
"And who told you that? Your girlfriend Penny?"
I swallow down a jagged lump. "Did you kill my brother?"
"Your brother?" Her voice changes, dips to an octave that is no longer Gigi's, but is Aurora's. "You expect me to remember your brother? One boy from the thousands who've fallen in love with me?" She says it with a laugh, as if to fall in love is the first step toward death.
"It was last summer, June 11th, he tries, hoping this will jog her memory. But even if she did remember, she would never confess. Not to him.
Doesn't ring a bell.
I hear footsteps move across the room. Beau's, and his voice is farther away now. "Did you drown anyone on June 11th?
Let me think. Her tone takes on an upswing, like she's shifting between Gigi's voice and Aurora's, playing a game with Beau that he will lose. "Nope," she finally concludes. "Pretty sure I took that day off. A girl gets tired with so many boys fawning over her." I'm surprised she's being so candid with him, even if her answers are still veiled by untruths. She must have recognized that he's not fooled by her little act. He sees right through Gigi Cly, even if he can't actually see the thing inside her.
"I can make you tell me," he says, his voice like a steel nail driving into wood, and I push open the door, unable to stay quiet any longer. Gigi isn't sitting like I thought. She's standing at the far wall beside one of the windows, leaning against it like she's watching the ocean for a ship sailing into the harbor that might rescue her. And Beau is only a couple feet away, shoulders drawn back, hands halfway flexed at his sides like he's about to reach forward and wrap them around her throat.
"Beau," I hiss. He doesn't turn around right away. He stares at her, like maybe he'll see a flicker of his brother in her eyes, of the moment right before he was killed. Gigi lifts a hand, smiling a little. "Poor boy," she says in her smoothest, most condescending tone. "I can't help you find your brother, but I can show you exactly what he felt." Her fingers rise toward his face, her eyes piercing into his. "It won't hurt, I promise. In fact, you'll beg me for more." The tips of her fingers are only an inch away, about to touch his cheekbone. "I can show you things your girlfriend Penny can't. She's too afraid to really love you." And just when her hand is almost to his jaw, he grabs her wrist, coiling his fingers around her skin. She winces slightly, and then he forces her arm away, where it falls to her side. Her eyebrows rise in unison, and she glances over at me from across the room, like she wants to make sure I saw how close she was to making him hers. "I like the ones who play hard to get," she says with a wink. I drop the blanket and two sandwiches onto the small kitchen table with a thump, then turn for the door, and Beau is suddenly right behind me. "If you miss me, Beau," she cajoles, smirking as she watches us leave, "you know where to find me." But Beau slams the door shut and slides the board back into place.
"You were right," he says. "She's one of them."
Beau and I walk the perimeter of the island like we're surveying it, watchmen on duty, scanning the boundary for marauders, as if the Swan Sisters were going to swim ashore by the thousands and take over our small island. I am on edge, fidgety, certain none of this will end well. Gigi Cly is locked in the boathouse. People will be looking for her.
Davis and Lon want her dead. The Sparrow police are trying to locate her and return her to her parents. And we were somehow right in the middle of it. I'm still not entirely sure what we're going to do with her. Do you want to come up to the house for dinner? I ask Beau when the sun starts to set. We've spent most of our time in his cottage, alone, never in the main house. He lifts his hat to brush a hand through his hair before placing it back on his head, lower this time, so it's hard to see his eyes.
What about your mom?
She won't mind. And it wasn't really a request, but a demand. I'm not about to leave you alone. You might decide to go for a swim again. I say it with a grin, even though it's not funny. He smirks, looking across the island to Old Fisherman's cottage, where Gigi is locked up. The wood board is still in place.
All right, he agrees.
I heat a can of tomato soup and make two grilled cheese sandwiches on the stove. A simple meal. There aren't a lot of options anyway. I need to go into town for more supplies. Eventually. But I'm not in a rush to leave the island. We eat quickly, and then Beau follows me up the stairs. When we reach my bedroom, I can hear the fan blowing down the hall. Mom's already in bed.
Do you think your mom knows I'm here?
Beau asks once we're inside my room. She knows. She senses when anyone is in the house or on the island.
What about Gigi?
I'm sure Mom knows she's here too, but she won't say anything. She hasn't talked to anyone outside the island for a couple years. I don't think she could muster the strength to call the cops about a missing girl even if she wanted to.
Is she like that because of your dad?
I give a swift nod and sit down on the edge of the bed while he settles into the cushioned chair beside the window. After he vanished 3 years ago, she sort of lost her mind. He nods, understanding.
I'm sorry.
A light rain has started to fall, sprinkling the glass and pattering against the roof, a chorus that soothes the eaves and sharp angles of the old house. Apparently, love is the worst kind of madness. I go to the window and touch my palm to the glass. I can feel the coolness of the rain on the other side. Have you ever been in love before? Beau braves to ask. I look back at him, absorbing the drowsy slant of his eyes. Once, I confess, the four-letter words spilling out. It's something I don't like to talk about. With anyone.
And?
It didn't last. Circumstances beyond our control.
But you think about him still? He asks.
Only sometimes.
Are you afraid?
Of what?
To fall in love again?
His hands are resting on the arms of the chair, relaxed, but his gaze seems far more intent. No. I swallow down the heartbeat climbing up inside my throat. Can he see what I'm thinking? What I'm feeling? That my heart is already pooling in my stomach? That my mind can hardly think of anything but him? That when we're together, I almost believe nothing else matters? That maybe he could save me and I could save him? I used to be afraid that I wouldn't get another chance to. He stands up from the chair and walks to the window, pressing his shoulders against the wood frame. A hard line from his jaw up to his temple.
How did you know you were in love?
His question makes my fingertips tingle with the need to touch his face, show him the feeling bursting from my seams. It felt like sinking, I say. I know it might be an odd way to describe it, considering the prevailing death in this town, but it's how it comes out. Like you're drowning. But it doesn't matter because you don't need air anymore. You just need the other person. His eyes flick to mine, searching them, looking to see if I'm drowning. And I am. The clock beside my bed ticks through the seconds. The rain keeps time.
Penny, he says softly, tilting his gaze on me. I didn't come here to this town expecting any of this.
He looks to the floor, then back up again.
If I hadn't met you, it probably would have been easier, less complicated. Maybe I would have left days ago.
I frown, and he clears his throat. His words break apart, then reform. This is hard for him.
But now I know.
He lets out a breath, eyes looking through me, turned wild and unwavering.
I'm not leaving here without you, even if it means I have to wait.
I'll wait. I'll wait in this miserable place for as long as it takes. And if you want me to stay, then I'll stay. I'll fucking stay here forever if you ask me to.
He shakes his head and opens his mouth like he's going to continue, but I don't let him.
I take one swift step forward and crush my lips to his, pressing away his thoughts, his words. He tastes like a summer wind far away from here, like absolution, like a boy from a different life, like we could make memories that belong only to us, memories that have nothing to do with this place. A life, maybe. A real life.
I open my eyes. I trace his lips with mine.
He looks at me like I am a girl brought in with the tide, rare and scarred and broken. A girl found in the roughest waters, in the farthest reaches of a dark fairy tale. He is looking at me like he might love me.
I'm scared, I whisper up at him.
Of what? Of letting myself love you, then feeling my insides collapse when I lose you.
I'm not going anywhere without you.
Promises are easy to make, I think, but don't say. Because I know he believes his own words. He believes that what we feel right now will rescue us in the end. But I know. I know. Endings are never so simple. I sink back against the wall. His hand still touches my forearm, not letting me go.
How does it end? He asks, as if his thoughts trailed mine. What will happen on the summer solstice?
Memories cascade through me. All the years past, the summers that slid to a close, dead bodies left in their wake. There will be a party, just like the one on the beach. I pull my arm away from his grip, tugging the sleeves of my sweater down over my hands and crossing my arms, feeling suddenly chilled. Before midnight, the sisters will wade back out into the harbor, relinquishing the bodies they've stolen.
And if they don't go into the water? If Gigi stays locked up during the solstice?
My lungs stop drawing in air. She will die. She will be trapped inside Gigi's body indefinitely, pushed down into the dark, dark, dark recesses of Gigi's mind. She will see and hear and witness the world, but Gigi will resume control, unaware that a swan sister is now imprisoned inside her, buried deep within. A ghost inside a girl. The worst kind of existence. A punishment befitting the torment the sisters have caused. But I don't tell this to Beau, because I can't be sure it's true, since it's never happened before. A swan sister has never stayed inside a body past midnight on the summer solstice.
I'm not sure, I answer truthfully.
Beau's eyes have strayed to the window. He's considering something.
I have to kill her, he finally says. Even if she didn't kill my brother, she's killed others. She doesn't deserve to live.
You'd be killing Gigi too, I say.
I know, but you told me before how the town has killed girls in the past, hoping to stop the sisters, but that they always got it wrong.
His eyes search mine.
This time we won't get it wrong. You can see them. You know who they are. We can find out where the third one is, and we can end this for good. No one else has to die.
Except three innocent girls.
Better than 100 more boys, or 200.
How many more centuries do they keep returning to this town before someone stops them? They never got it right in the past because they never knew for sure which girls were inhabited. But we know. And there's one right